Well, thank you very much, Ambassador, for that, and thank you very much for hosting us here, in spite of the very tight public expenditure constraints. We have in fact paid for the lights to stay on until 9 p.m. But then they go off, and we all have to go. I'm sure it's very positive that the government and William Hague came to attempt to revitalise or strengthen the relationship between the UK and China. But it seems slightly odd that the Prime Minister has gone to India rather than China this week. Perhaps the British Airways plane ran out of fuel and he just had to land there. Or maybe they went on strike, which they do quite often.
He's coming back.
But this is, it's quite clear that the government is attaching a very high priority to relationships with China and India, which is, of course, totally fair to treat them, I think, on all fours. Now, what I plan to do this evening, as quickly as I can, is really talk about something which is a new book that I have written, which actually, curiously, is published tomorrow. So you can order it on Amazon now, but it is supposedly, the copies will be in my office when I get back, but they weren't when I left. And the hypothesis of this book, or the reason I have reason I wrote it, was I think that this financial crisis is a slightly odd phenomenon in that normally when you have a big disaster, whether it's a natural disaster or a man-made disaster, as this one is, you begin with a range of explanations being offered. You know, people offer whole kinds of theories, many of them slightly strange. They say it's to do with the sun, or it's a conspiracy by the CIA, or, you know, something. And then gradually, as you learn more about it, you kind of converge on a central explanation. And maybe there'll still be some differences of view, but essentially you start to converge as you understand more about it. It strikes me that with this financial crisis, actually the opposite is true. That when the crisis began, it seemed clear that it was about an explosion in the US subprime mortgage market, which had been allowed to get out of hand. And essentially, if we'd been sitting here in the autumn of 2007, or indeed even through to the summer of 2008, probably that's the story we would have told each other about why this crisis had erupted. But interestingly, as time has gone on and the crisis has kind of transmogrified into a number of different crises, we've started to be rather less sure about what the underlying explanations for this crisis are. And so what I've done in this book is essentially take all the explanations that there have been, whether it's the subprime one, or whether it's to do with bankers' pay, or to do with hedge funds, or to do with the weaknesses of the credit rating agencies, or offshore centres, or indeed China has created these distortions with its own sort of export model. That's a story that you now quite often hear. And I've attempted to explore each of them separately. So in fact, I've written 38 essays, so there are 38 different hypotheses about this crisis that I have found. But what I plan to do this evening, therefore, is to take you through all of these 38, and because you're very clever LSD people, I think I can do each of them in probably 5 minutes each, I think. And then at the end, we'll have a vote as to which ones you think make sense. So, you're going to be here for quite a long time. We'll have to put an extra few renminbi in the electricity meter because this could take a while. Now, actually, what I aim to do is to try to give you actually chapter 39, where I attempt a summary of which of, what the explanation, a single coherent explanation, I think, can be. But then to focus, as the title suggests, on what's being done to correct the problems that we've identified and how far the current reform programme is really delivering against what I see to be the underlying causes of the crisis. And then I'll just say a little bit about at the end, therefore, about how the world looks as we claw our way out of this crisis. Now, I know, of course, that in China, you're doing much more than clawing your way out of the crisis with growth of 11%. But let me tell you, in Europe, we still, well, some would argue that we have still not followed the first rule of holes. And the first rule of being in a hole, as you know, is stop digging. And we are still, in some respects, digging. That's rather unfortunate. Anyway, I'm going to proceed pretty quickly because I know that LSE students, one, have a very good ability to understand things delivered quickly, and two, have a very low boredom threshold and get very fed up if things don't go fast. So, let me say something about what I think the underlying causes of the crisis are, and in one slide, as it were, I think that we have to begin with overall financial conditions, and that global imbalances created a massive inflow of liquidity into Western economies. I don't say this as any kind of blame of the surplus countries, the oil exporters and China. It is just observable fact that there were large flows of liquidity into the developed economies. And that those led, combined with loose monetary policy, to a mispricing of risk. And therefore, people were prepared to pay high prices for extremely risky assets. And fundamentally, that's why you saw things like in the subprime market, there was a great demand for people because yields were very low, and investors were therefore looking for ways of enhancing yield and were prepared to buy things which were actually inherently very risky, but at prices that did not reflect that risk. So risk became mispriced, and we then had credit and asset price bubbles linked, because if you have a credit bubble, you tend also to have asset price bubbles, whether they're housing or indeed in the equity market. This was all facilitated by things going wrong in the financial system. In other words, the financial system generated a massive increase in leverage, that there was this demand for credit, but of course, just the fact that there's demand for credit doesn't necessarily mean there is supply. But the financial sector was prepared to supply credit, apparently without limit, using exotic and fancy instruments. And the regulatory system did not offset it. And I prefer to put it that way than to say the regulatory system, you know, was to blame, because I don't think that regulation is necessarily as powerful as some people think. And having been a regulator for a decade, I think I can speak with some authority. You can be a kind of speed bump in the road, but you can't necessarily stop the traffic. You know, you can make life a bit more difficult, but against the conditions, with very loose financial conditions, very loose monetary policy, the powers of regulators to stop that were very limited. And this all contributed to a massive growth of the financial sector with hugely complicated new instruments, which generated a lot of confusion. And the hypothesis which we had about the financial sector was that if it generated new instruments which allowed risk to be traded in more and more sophisticated ways, this must be a good thing. That, and many of you who've done finance and have been embedded in, you know, efficient markets theory will know what I'm talking about, that, you know, in principle, if you can trade risks in a more sophisticated way, that must allow risks to be borne by those people who are most able to bear it. And this must be a good thing. You know, this is a more sophisticated, more complete market. And if you make markets more complete, that's got to be a good thing. Unfortunately, some of these exotic instruments were so complicated that far from mitigating risk, they actually created new risks, and people ended up holding instruments they didn't understand, and furthermore, those instruments were often correlated, strongly correlated with each other. So things that looked like hedges turned out not to be. The correlations all went to one. And so this increasing complexity and size of the financial sector sort of accumulated the problem. So you've got surplus liquidity, loose monetary policy, excess leverage, and extreme financial complexity. And all of this generated a very nasty mess. Just a few pictures on that. I mean, this is what happened to the global current account imbalances, which started to expand very, very dramatically from 2002 onwards. So this is not a long-running story. These were quite tolerable before that, but they just exploded. The green bar is the United States, and the blue bar is China, but it's also the oil exporters were massive exporters of liquidity. Then, if you look at monetary policy, the red line is the Fed line. Those of you, how many people actually did economics here? Must be some. Yeah, okay. Well, this is the Taylor rule, you know, which is normally describes the reaction function of central banks quite well in relation to inflation and the output gap. And for a long period of time, Fed monetary policy typically followed something like the Taylor rule. But we, after the 2001 crash, dot-com boom and bust, Greenspan banged interest rates down in order to prevent the dot-com boom turning into a recession and help low. And that, in my argument, generated these very loose monetary conditions. Leverage, well, this is what happened to household debts. So, you know, a lot of this is a household phenomenon. The tall dark bar is the UK. We actually beat the Americans in terms of the amount of debt that we were prepared to take on. And this, of course, was closely related to house prices. Dramatic change in house prices. Now, this is Bob Shiller's calculation, the Case-Shiller Index, where from 1930 to 1997, house prices in the US grew at 0.7% in real terms a year. And from 1998 to 2006, they grew at 8%. Now, this can't be a supply and demand phenomenon. You know, the American population didn't suddenly start to grow more rapidly. They didn't suddenly stop building houses. This is a credit-driven phenomenon. This is because there was too much money and too easy availability of credit. And it wasn't just an American phenomenon. House prices rose rapidly in much of Europe. Indeed, in most cases, they rose more rapidly in Europe over that decade than in the United States. Some of this, understandable, catch up. You know, Ireland caught up, and Spain was sort of catching up with house prices elsewhere. But this was clearly a lot of what we say now. Clearly, of course, in retrospect, but you know, this does look like a pretty dramatic set of changes. If you then look at what happened on banks' balance sheets, this is the U.S. banks. The aggregate assets in relation to tangible book value. But effectively, this is the line going up, and the leverage became, you know, somewhere in the mid-40s by 2007. Whereas as recently as 2003, you know, it was only at 30 times. I mean, this was a very, very big expansion. This is where, of course, you have to say what were the regulators doing at this point, because clearly they were allowing a massive increase in leverage. In addition, there was the parallel banking market. So it wasn't just within banks that credit rose, it was in the securitization markets, and these were, of course, as we know, often held in off-balance sheet vehicles, and therefore didn't attract capital, didn't attract reserves in the same way as you do on a bank balance sheet. So the credit creation that looks pretty dramatic in the banking system was even more dramatic because this was what was happening in the securitization markets. I think there's also another problem with securitization which has emerged, which is that the disciplines between borrowers and lenders vanish in complex securitization chains. In other words, you know, normally you'd say, well, the lender is interested in the credit quality of the borrower. But actually what happened in the US mortgage market is the borrower finds a mortgage agent. The mortgage agent has a line of credit arranged with a local bank. provides the mortgage. Before it's touched the bank balance sheet, it's been packaged and sold to an investment bank. The investment bank has tranched it, repackaged it, and sold it to an unsuspecting German state-owned regional bank. And that state-owned regional bank has no knowledge at all of the credit quality of the borrower, and this is supposedly insured by a monoline insurer, so it looks like a AAA credit, and there's no kind of discipline in this chain anymore. So the securitisation market was a big part of the story. This is what I was saying about the sort of magnification, because so the credit creation was actually bigger than the securitization market numbers showed, because these securities were retranched and people took the triple B tranche, got a monoline insurer to insure it, and then retranched it into some AAA bits. So this, if you remember, in late 2007, the super senior subprime tranches were actually created out of a triple B tranche, and just insured by a monoline insurer, which turned out then actually to be valueless because the monoline insurer went bust as soon as the market started to go down. But in return for that, the credit rating agency said, oh, fine, that's AAA. And this is not just an American phenomenon. This is what happened to UK banks' leverage, which exploded. And what I like this chart particularly because I left the FSA here. It's fine when I left. I don't know what happened after that. But, you know, our banks shared in this euphoria. Now, what are the consequences of this? Well, in my view, this points to some important lessons for monetary policy. And this is the bit of the debate that one hears rather less about. And I published a book just a couple of months ago called Banking on the Future, which is about the future of central banking in the light of the crisis, in which I go into this argument at 350 pages long, which may be more than you or anybody needs. But essentially, monetary policy had become very narrowly focused on retail price inflation. And, you know, the Federal Reserve defense and the Bank of England defense and the ECB defense, when they're presented with all this, it's just a minute. You know, retail price inflation was fine. You know, it was all through this period, you could present another set of charts showing that apparently everything was just fine because inflation was 2% on average through this period. And that's what the central banks were told to focus on. That's the UK inflation target, and the ECB has that in the treaty, and the Fed is told to focus on stable prices, succeeding. But of course, around it, this massive explosion of credit was underway. And I think you need to bring credit back into monetary policy and also a better understanding of financial intermediation. And that, in a sense, part of the background to the UK reform of trying to bring the FSA and the Bank of England closer together. And clearly, with a stronger emphasis on offsetting the risk of financial instability. And that's why in the US, the new legislation gives the Fed a role in systemic stability. It's supposed to oversee the stability of the system as a whole. It's why in the UK they're sort of trying to pull the bank and the regulation together, and why in the European Union, the Monetary Union, they've set up a European systemic risk board chaired by the president of the ECB. So these measures have been taken. How effective they will be is, of course, rather difficult because, you know, it's not always easy to identify a bubble when it is expanding. And bubbles, you know about in China. You're good at this. But, you know, it isn't always clear. You know, there have been people who said in the past that Shanghai property prices are a huge bubble, but, you know, they're now twice as high as when people said they were a bubble. You know, so you can't, it's very difficult to know in advance. But undoubtedly, this crisis was so bad that you've got to be able to do better than that, it seems to me. You know, you have to be able to react more expeditiously. So this is, that's really, I think, in a way, the most important part of the story. But, of course, there is also the pure regulatory dimension. And the crisis did reveal problems with the regulatory architecture. A very complicated global structure, lacking a central authority to drive change, and the most vivid example of that was the Basel rules on bank capital. You know, there was the Basel II you read about. That took a decade, and it still wasn't completed when the crisis hit, because there was nobody driving that process. A US system that was balkanized and ineffective, a European system which was neither truly European nor truly national, with a complicated mixture of responsibilities, and a lot of mismatches between different national systems, which made them very difficult to work one with another. That's the global regulatory system. That's taken from the Chinese edition of my other book. That's the third one I mentioned. This is sounding like a bookseller's convention here, but a book on global financial regulation I produced a couple of years ago, which is now available in Chinese. I mean, no doubt you all have your own copies already. And the European system is even more complicated. No one can understand. Actually, it looks better in Chinese than it does in English or in French. It looks faintly more comprehensible. But, you know, there are a massive number of bodies, and not, thankfully, you know, you would be thankful that the police are there going to go through them all, but, you know, the whole thing is sort of built up in a very undisciplined way. And there are six problems with it, really. One, it's very, very complicated. Two, it's built on the old model of banking, securities and insurance, which, of course, came together in the crisis in complicated ways. The membership was unrepresentative, so you had a financial stability forum in the centre, which was supposed to look at emerging risks in the financial system, but in which China was not there, and nor were any of the oil producers. So if you look back at the chart on global imbalances, you only had the people on, you know, one half of the line and not the other. So there was no kind of oversight involving the key new players in the global economy. It was excessively dominated by the United States, no single European voice, and as I say, no kind of authority or hierarchy in the system. Now, the G20 has, of course, been trying to deal with this, and the G20 has done a number of quite important things, most of them in the London summit last year, where a financial stability forum has been turned into a financial stability board, in itself, just renaming something doesn't make a lot of difference, but the ministers have now said they look to the financial stability board to organise the rest of the system, so I think it is a material and meaningful change. They have expanded the membership of all these bodies, so China now suddenly is a member of the Financial Stability Board, of the Basel Committee, of the IOSCO Committee, that's the securities regulators, and everything else. This is, interestingly, posing quite a lot of challenges to Chinese institutions, because, you know, these are complicated games to play. You know, the Basel Committee is a very complicated mechanism, and the negotiations in it are very complicated. We've been playing it for 25 years, but we still don't really know how the game is played. And for the Chinese to sort of suddenly turn up, you know, and get involved in these negotiations, which are going on at great speed, is a challenge. The people who are competent at it, of course, are the people who are educated at the LSE, which is quite a number of people at the CBRC and CSRC, in fact, went through the school. In addition, a few other things on offshore centres, credit rating agencies, but the really big and important things, I think, are the American system, which I would like to say a word or two about, and particularly sort of these two things. Because, you know, the big lesson of the massive expansion of credit was that there was too little capital in the banking system. You know, that banks were allowed to expand, increase their leverage, and then when the losses hit, it turned out that they didn't have the reserves to cope. And therefore, a whole range of banks, whether it was Citibank in the US or the Royal Bank of Scotland in the UK, And it's very important to note that we only had a Scottish banking crisis in the UK. It was the Royal Bank of Scotland, Halifax Bank of Scotland were the real, and Northern Rock was quite close to the board. This is a point, as an Englishman, I like to just to make clear. The ambassador, of course, had the disadvantage of having to represent Scotland and Wales and Northern Ireland, but I don't. We have almost no Scottish students at the LSE, as you probably know. The key things really are, how far are we getting on with reforming the system in the light of this analysis of the crisis? Well, US regulation, the charge sheet here, and I'm just picking two or three out of my 38, you'll be pleased to know, but this is the way I approach it in the book. What is the charge levelled against this bit of the system? What was it supposed to have done? What's wrong with it, and how far have we dealt with it? Well, the charge in the US is that the system is balkanised, over-complex, and riddled with interagency turf wars. In fact, one former Treasury Secretary did say, Paulson said, it was like the blind man in the room with the elephant. Could feel one part of it, but couldn't see just, how big this wretched thing was. And all the different regulators in the US were feeling different little parts of the elephant, but they couldn't put together the picture and understand really what was going on. There is no federal insurance regulator. This is rather relevant to AIG, which of course is quite important in this part of the world. The SEC and the CFTC are regularly in dispute. State regulation cuts across federal, and there was no system-wide regulator. Well, what have they done? Dodd-Frank Act just passed, signed by the President, the great fanfare last week. Well, it has done a little bit of simplification. One regulator out of, when I was in the FSA, I had 75 opposite numbers in the United States. One of them has been abolished. So it's gone down to 74. And the Fed, importantly, and this is significant, has been given system-wide authority. And some other important changes, derivatives on exchange, etc. But there's still no insurance regulator, and the SEC and the CFTC are separate. It's the only country in the world that thinks it makes sense to regulate equities and derivatives in different regulators. No other country thinks that can work, and they're right. And so the American reform, in my view, is pretty much a halfway house. I'm not very comfortable with where they've got. Politics of it are, of course, hopelessly difficult with the way legislation is produced in the United States. But, I think if you're grading the response to this problem, it would be tough to give it more than about 50%. That would be probably generous.
There is the sort of too big to fail question, which of course was another big issue.
Some people argue that it was the abolition of the Glass-Steagall Act, which allowed banks and securities to come together in the US, which was part of the problem. Now, in my view, I just don't agree with this, because actually, if you look around the world at the different categories of institution and look at the shape of them, in each category you look at, there were some who did very well and some who did very badly. So if you take the investment banks, there were really five big investment banks in the US. Bear Stearns failed, Lehman Brothers failed, Merrill Lynch sort of survived, but only by tucking itself under Bank of America. Morgan Stanley, of which I'm on the board, I should say, we survived, bruised, somewhat battered, but we survived. And Goldman's, what's the problem? Goldman's have made money all the way through this. That's their problem. They've made too much money. But it's not. It's hard to say there was something fundamentally wrong with this business model. And then look at the universal banks. You can look at the ones like Deutsche Bank, UBS, Credit Suisse, probably the three in Europe. UBS almost collapsed completely, had to be rescued by the Swiss government. Deutsche, you know, had some difficulties, but has got through okay. Credit Suisse, absolutely fine. There's no two institutions more like each other than Credit Suisse and UBS. And yet one went this way and one went that way. So I don't believe this structural argument. I just don't think that there's a structural solution which delivers you safe institutions. So it's not really part of my explanation of the crisis. What have we had? Well, you've got the Volcker Rule, which will prohibit some proprietary trading, which is actually not a big deal, even for Goldman. And elsewhere, I don't think there is going to be change of this kind. I don't think the Germans are going to break up Deutsche Bank. I don't think the Swiss are going to break up Credit Suisse. So in my view, this kind of too big to fail, Glass-Steagall thing, is not a central part of the argument. Others may disagree. Let's go on to the capital shortage. Here the charge is banks were allowed to operate with too little capital, leverage grew, revenues inadequate to cover losses when asset prices fell. Do I think this charge is proved? Yes. I don't particularly like the Glass-Steagall one. This one seems to me to be true. Question is, what to do about it? Well, Basel III will triple capital in the trading book, and the real issue here was that banks have banking books, which is, you know, for those who are not bankers, loans you aim to hold to maturity. You know, I lend to you and I don't expect to sell the loan, I expect you to pay me back at the end of the 5 years or whatever. That's the banking bit. And then there's the trading book, where, you know, I may buy a securitization, but I might sell it tomorrow if someone offers me more for it. You know, that's the trading part of what I do. And we used to think, and this is where I certainly would put my hands up as a former regulator, and certainly this is the view I shared, was that there wasn't really that much risk in the trading book. Because, you know, a lot of it was hedged anyway, and what the hell, if they were losing money, they'd sell. You know, they'd just sell and liquidate. And of course, it turned out that there were conditions in the market when prices started to fall sharply where you couldn't sell to anyone. There was no market, and the price moves were so dramatic that they just weren't envisaged in the models. So there was far more risk, and also where the hedges turned out not to be hedges. You know, whereas I said, when normally you buy an asset you think will go down when this one goes up, but actually when the market really goes crazy, they both go down. And so what looks like a hedge is not a hedge. It actually doubles your risk. So quite clearly, we can't allow in banks this massive amount of trading in the trading book without more capital. So that will go up, and that's, I think everybody kind of accepts that, that's fine. But the rest of it is, of course, tricky. And one may have seen this week that the Basel Committee has come out with some proposals now, having put out some very tough ideas 6 months ago. They've now come back and said, well, maybe we won't do quite that. Because, of course, every time you get a bank to hold more capital, it increases the cost of credit. You've got to hold reserves which are not being remunerated. You know, you've got to increase your deposits with People's Bank here, and you don't get paid on those, or you get paid some trivial amount. And so the more you have to do that, the less you can lend, and the more credit costs. And at the moment, the governments, and certainly a lot of European governments, are saying two mutually conflicting things. They say, one, we want more capital in the banking system for the banks to be safer and not to have this awful problem again. And two, we want the banks to lend more to small businesses. You know, they say the same thing. And sometimes they say these two things in the same speech. And you kind of wonder, you know, what's going on here. But this is a very difficult question, because I could make any bank completely safe. It's easy. All you do is you say every 100 renminbi they have on deposit, they must deposit all of that with the People's Bank. Job done. Bank is perfectly safe. Doesn't pay you any interest, doesn't lend you any money, but it's safe. So it's just like a box then. You know, it's just like a safe, really. So clearly, as soon as you're allowed to lend and as soon as you allow to pay interest, risk enters the system. The question is, how much risk do we want to take? And at the moment, we're in a curious position where what we're saying is, we'd love you to have more capital, but not yet. Because at the moment we want you to lend in order to promote the recovery. So this is the any Catholics in the room, and there is at least one Irish Catholic at the back of the room, will know this is known as the St. Augustine approach. St. Augustine famously said, "Make me chaste, O Lord, but not yet." And that is the current position that we're in. Everybody in theory agrees this, but actually isn't really prepared to do it because of the implications for the recovery. But in the long run, I think there will be more capital in the banking system. Credit will be somewhat more expensive as a result. And I think this will, in the long run, and this is particularly important for China, I think, in the long run, you will need more development of the bond markets and the equity markets. And China, it depends very, very heavily on bank credit. And bank credit is going to be more expensive because these rules will be international and your banks will be affected like anyone else. And you're a member of the Basel Committee now, so you can't get out of it. And that will mean that there's going to be an important policy objective will be to develop equity and bond markets. And I heard a speech the night before last from Dai Shanglong, who was the governor of the People's Bank before Xiao Xiaochuan, who now runs the National Social Security Fund, who was very clear on this. He said there's a very clear policy objective here now to develop the bond markets. And China's been wanting to do it for a while, but this is going to make it even more important because bank credit is going to be more expensive than it used to be.
French cyclicality, this is the last one that I shall really focus on. This is also very tricky. Ambassador referred to the Bank of England in future having responsibility for macroprudential regulation, and this is really what he was talking about. He said he wasn't an economist. He may or may not have known this is what he was talking about, but this is what he was talking about. Of course he did, yeah. One of the charges is that the capital rules tended to accentuate the cycle, allowing banks to hold less capital as asset prices rose, as backtesting revealed low losses and loss given default over previous years. Maybe that sounds a bit complicated. Let me explain how it works. You're the regulator. You go to a bank. You have to determine how much capital that bank needs given the lending that it's made. Let's assume it's, a third of its lending is to government, a third of its lending is to big corporations, and a third of its lending is to households to borrow mortgages. And so you take the book and you say, right, how risky is it? Well, I don't know. How do you find that out? Well, one thing you can do, and the most obvious thing you can do, is to say, well, if you had those loans that you've got now, if you've had them for the previous 10 years of the previous economic cycle, how much would you have lost at the worst point? So when the property market was in the most trouble, how much would you have lost on mortgages? How much would you have lost on big corporations? How many defaults were there on corporate loans at the worst point in the cycle, when the economy was in recession? And then you can see what they would have lost holding the book they got now all the way through the back period. And then you can say, well, you've got to keep at least that amount of reserves, because there could be another low point in the cycle when you lose a lot of money. So that's your starting point. And then you probably add a bit for luck. Now, the issue is that, of course, take the mortgage bit. Well, if house prices rise and rise and rise, then, of course, even if the borrower defaults, as the lender, you don't lose any money because you get the house back and you sell it. And you sell it for more than the loan because the house prices have been going up. So, actually, if you have a really long house price boom, and I've just showed you the numbers, for these European countries and the US, had this long house price boom, right at the point where the market is about to collapse, the model tells you you don't need any capital at all, because you've never lost any money. So, clearly, this backward-looking thing is a problem if you get an unusual cycle. And, of course, the problem with the business cycle is you never know how long it is. We had a very long cycle, which is one of the big issues. One reason why we had so much trouble in our banking system is that we had 16 years, 64 consecutive quarters of growth in the UK economy.
really long cycle. By our standards, hugely long cycle. We've never had a cycle that long for, well, I don't think in the 20th century at all. And so, you know, that was the point where people got used to the idea you never lost money. You know, you always had growth. So you never lost money on small business loans, you never lost money on mortgages. So the models had all of these 16 years built into them backwards, which were all good years, and were telling you that you needed less and less capital. So the question is, how do you prevent that? And that's what this idea of a macroprudential mechanism is, which allows you to sort of lean into the wind. In other words, to say, well, you know, house prices, they've been going up for years, but now the price-income ratio, you know, the ratio of the average house price to average incomes is at some level which it's never been before, and so, you know, surely the risk is that there is some downward adjustment. It doesn't look like it at the moment, you know, prices are going up and up, there must be more of a risk. And you sort of try to anticipate these downturns and get the banks to tighten credit when asset prices are accelerating. Sounds great, and, you know, best of luck to the Bank of England doing this, but because, of course, one, you don't know easily where you are in the cycle, and two, of course, it's politically extremely unpopular. Because, you know, what it's like when house prices are rising, everybody wants to get in the market, everybody wants to borrow, and if suddenly, you know, the Bank of England pops up, or the FSA pops out and says, well, we don't like this, we think it's all gone crazy, and, you know, we're going to tighten the ratios and increase the price of credit, you know, you're going to get a riot. I mean, you know, people won't like this. So this is brave stuff. It sounds easy now. Because of having seen this awful crash, you know, you can get it, everybody will put their hands up and say, do you think that we should have macroprudential requirements and tighten credit? And say, oh, yeah. But when it comes to it, let me tell you, it won't be so popular. So, you know, getting a kind of methodology to this is going to be crucial. So, in principle, I think this is a good idea, but implementing it is going to be very difficult indeed. Let me just get close and conclude just in 5 minutes, because I've focused on these sort of regulatory issues, because I think in some ways, I mean, they're currently in the big public debate, you know, the Basel Committee coming out this week and everything. But it's important, I think, for completeness to note that actually failures in financial firms themselves may have been even more important. Because as I pointed out, you look at any category of firm, there were some winners and some losers. Some people did this badly. You know, even in a difficult environment, some people survived perfectly well and others collapsed. And there are clearly problems in risk management, clearly problems in the way banks themselves allocated capital, because, you know, it shouldn't really be for the regulators to tell you how much capital you need to survive. As a bank management, you should have a personal interest in keeping enough capital to allow you to survive. You know, you shouldn't have to sort of wait for the FSA to come along and tell you, or for the CBRC to come and tell you, you should have reserves. You know, your interest should be in staying in business. And so, you know, it's as much in the banks themselves as in the regulators, I think, that this went wrong. And here, I think, there's less evidence of change. And finally, of course, it comes back to the LSE. Because there are big problems with both economics and efficient markets. Krugman has said much of the past 30 years of macroeconomics was spectacularly useless at best, positively harmful at worst. So who are those people who had economics degrees? Because they're useless, it turns out. Absolutely useless. And Willem Bouter at the school said they referred to the unfortunate uselessness of most state-of-the-art academic monetary economics, which simply did not capture these risks in markets. You know, and there's a big critique developing at the moment of rational expectations basis of economics, and particularly also of, you know, the efficient markets hypothesis. Because when it came to it, you know, markets really were the very opposite of efficient. You know, these, you were, most of the economists here will know, much economics says, well, assume perfect and complete markets, you know, assume perfect information, and then we go on from there. And of course, you know, we couldn't assume any of these things. We couldn't assume we had major discontinuities in markets. And so a lot of the models on which risk management was built, you know, turned out to be completely useless and not to describe at all the way in which the markets worked. And even Greenspan, who in many other respects has been still a defender of the past, said the modern risk management paradigm elsewhere for decades, the whole intellectual edifice collapsed in the summer of last year. So how many people here have done finance or accounting at the LSE? Well, all useless, gone. Please hand your degrees back at the door and go and learn something else. So this is
very serious because anyone who has done that. Now, let me just end with two very quick things about the prospect. Well, the latest G20 says, you know, global economy recovers, but now in the West, anyway, the focus of this crisis has shifted again. I mean, we're not really now so much worried. Banks are still, we're worried about them, but we're worried about them for a particular reason, which is that they're stuck with government debt. And government debt from governments, it would look as if, well, they just might not be able to repay it. And what we've now seen, and the ambassador again referred to the British government's response, you know, is a significant problem, a fiscal problem building up in Europe. And one of the really fascinating things to note is the difference now between advanced and developing economies. And these are the latest figures by the IMF, but actually sort of reworked by Deutsche Bank, which looks at government debt as a percentage of GDP and takes the forecasts for the next 4 years and what governments themselves are saying they're doing about it. And in spite of the tough decisions that some governments have made about how they're going to reduce the deficits, you know, what you see is now the average for advanced economies is over 100% of GDP, whereas for developing countries it's 40, and still scheduled in advanced economies to rise and to fall in major developing countries. And this is a pretty dramatic difference, and is really, in my mind, one rather vivid way of explaining why I think that there is going to be a shift in the centre of economic gravity towards developing countries. To the east, we conventionally say, but actually, interestingly, Africa is doing quite well at the moment, growing much more rapidly. I mean, they're still a lot smaller, of course, but the growth rates are pretty healthy. And part of the reason for this is that developing countries have had more fiscal discipline. And part of the reason for that in this region, of course, was the Asian financial crisis of the 1990s, which was a horrible lesson for many Asian countries in the risks of running an unstable fiscal policy, that you could suddenly have a huge currency collapse and you know, major disruption. And so most Asian countries learned that lesson extremely well and have run very disciplined fiscal policies. And this is now a very, very dramatic difference. And I think, you know, debt to GDP ratios above 100% just not going to be sustainable. And so the big story now, the crisis has kind of bounced on from the mortgage market through the banking market into fiscal policy, with governments now having a major adjustment problem. So how do things look? Well, the recovery is underway, very patchy. As I say, the world's economic centre of gravity is shifting east. But I think the fiscal headwinds, which are the sort of second-order consequence of the crisis, in other words, the reduction in government debt, will restrain growth in Europe and probably the US in due course. The US has more flexibility to cope with big fiscal deficits because, you know, they borrow only in their own currency, and as the sort of central reserve currency, they find it easier to borrow. And for reasons best known to you, you keep lending them the money. And the Chinese have now got whatever it is, $3 trillion of US treasuries. For the time being, that's still the way the world works. So the US can afford to be later in its tightening. We can't. I mean, we have to fund our debt in the market in a currency that is not necessarily one people need to hold. You know, sterling is not bad. A hedging mechanism, but you don't have to hold sterling. The Chinese government does not have to hold any
whereas, you know, frankly, it's unavoidable that the Chinese government holds dollar assets. And so, you know, we have a more serious problem in funding our deficit, so we have to get on with it earlier. Capital increases, I've explained to the banks, will come, but the time is uncertain. At the moment, I think domestic considerations are rather dominating the global regulatory agenda. You know, the US has gone into this act, which is quite unrelated to anything that's going on in Europe, frankly. You know, we're now doing another reform, which, again, isn't related to what's going on in the US, actually. So there's a lot of rather, you know, separate activity in individual countries. And also, I don't think that these regulatory reforms have addressed all of the problems, and particularly they haven't in the United States. I've left out around 30 of my 38 explanations, but for those you'll have to read the book. Thanks.
Hal, thank you very much indeed. I don't know how you want to...
Are you happy to sort of, do you want me to MC it, or do you
I'll be happy to.
Okay, very good.
That's right.
Go ahead.
If anyone has any questions or comments, I'd be happy to take it. Otherwise, I'll start to ask you. Well, some of you are going to be in trouble. Yeah.
Maybe not wonderful today, but you were analyzing imbalances in Europe and the US for quite some time. But now, if you're looking at China now, do you see some of the imbalances that you observe in the West could be avoided years ago in China as of today?
I think that the analysis I would have of the Chinese position would be, I think there are two areas of some nervousness in China. One is more short term and one is longer term. In the short term one, I think, is the property market. As some of you know, I'm an advisor to the CBRC and was here with them last month, and you know, Yu Mingfang of the CBRC has made no secret of the fact that, you know, he is concerned about some of the over-leverage of developers, indeed some of the local government platforms, you know, which have been engaging in development as well. And the CBRC and the People's Bank have been tightening reserve requirements and tightening deposit requirements for house lending, etc. And you know, the record of the financial authorities here over the last 15, 20 years is very good at, you know, at dampening down these things. I mean, essentially, what they're doing is macroprudential mechanisms. You know, they're doing it here in the way that we're now going to do. They've preserved here more micro tools, if you like, to sort of tighten things in particular market sectors than we have. And one interesting lesson out of this crisis, actually, is that the view taken in the West that actually you dismantled direct credit controls because they were never in use to you, was our view, and you just concentrated on the short-term interest rate, you know, maybe that's not necessarily quite as clever as we thought. And maybe you need a broader range of tools to deal with emerging bubbles in particular markets. And here, the CBRC and the PBOC do still have those tools. You know, they can say, well, if you want to buy a flat in Shanghai, you're going to have to put down 20%, you're going to have to put down 30%. Yeah, they can do that, which we don't have. And similarly, they can, you know, have loan-to-valuation rates that they will insist on being lower. You know, they say they won't lend below, you know, above 80% loan-to-valuation rate. So, in that area, there are signs of nervousness. But personally, I'm reasonably confident that the authorities have the tools and the determination to do something about it. The bigger issue, if you like, of quote imbalances, is the
ratio of both net exports and investment in the total GDP in China. And here I'm not saying anything particularly controversial, because the government, Wen Jiabao himself has said it, Hu Jintao has said it, that China needs to rebalance towards domestic consumption. And that's both desirable from a Liu standards point of view, but also, of course, one lesson from China in this crisis was that if you are excessively reliant on net exports, then you can be importing trouble from the rest of the world. Now, China responded very effectively with its fiscal stimulus, and it could afford to do so because its fiscal position was good. But nonetheless, the Chinese in the autumn of 2008 were not happy. They were very nervous. And there was a quarter where the economy pretty much stopped. And for China to have growth rates slipping down into 6 or 7% is not very comfortable. So I think that has accentuated the view that actually you need a slightly different growth balance, partly in order to make yourself less vulnerable to kind of contagion and crises from overseas. Now, how you achieve that, I don't know. I suspect that the next five-year plan, which we expect any moment now, will include some more measures to try to deal with that. Clearly, a gradual adjustment of the exchange rate is part of it, because that will have an effect. So I agree, I think there are some imbalances, but I expect that the authorities will take some measures to deal with it, say one of which being exchange rate. Another being the development of more security, social security systems, which give people more confidence to spend, because that's one of the reasons why they're reluctant to spend and save so much, etc. Yeah?
A lot is written about the RFPs throughout the year, going around for international, especially need to be gradually upwards. China did a couple of steps earlier this year. Where do you see the future of the world?
And I wish it were easier to go long with the renminbi for retail investors than it is. It's quite difficult. I think that, in the speech I heard from Dai Shanlong the other night, he was very clear about his view that the authorities had to allow some upward movement. I mean, he was careful about how much. But also that China should be moving towards greater convertibility of the renminbi and to removing some of the restrictions on overseas investors, etc. So I guess that's the way I would expect things to go. Precisely how quickly, I'm not quite sure. But that all the signs are that the renminbi, if the market were completely free, I think the renminbi would find a level somewhat higher than it currently is. Yep.
Your
person's
had a decent name. In the UK, there seems to be a sort of positive reception, maybe not on the back end of the funds, but the man on the street, but basically bankers. You had a flip on and started to address things like about sort of short term banking deals, in terms of the first itself, short term bonus process. How much do you think these popular resentment against what you paid for banking is just going up, the banking culture is just happening?
I think that there is a serious problem, and I didn't go into this in great detail, but I do think it is demonstrable that in many institutions there was very bad risk management, and they didn't think very hard about capital themselves, and there were some incentive structures which rewarded short-term risk taking, which were dangerous. But I find it quite difficult to see that as being absolutely the central mechanism that generated this crisis, frankly. One image that I think is quite a helpful one is that if the weather is very bad and there is freezing fog, a lot of driving, which in normal conditions would be quite safe, can result in accidents.
And essentially, I regard the kind of overall monetary conditions, financial conditions, as being like the weather, if you like. And perhaps the banks driving along in this didn't realise just how perilous the environment they were in was. So I think that there are specific cases where there were risk-taking behaviour which at individual desks led to people taking exaggerated positions which caused problems for the banks. But actually, if you look at, you know, the people who were really ultimately responsible at the top for the failure, say, of Lehman Brothers, you know, they lost, they as individuals, lost hundreds of millions out of this failure. You know, it wasn't that they were selling their shares, they weren't. They believed in all of this. You know, they believed it was work. I mean, that's the worst thing. So this kind of notion that there was a sort of cynical, you know, that you were taking all these risks and you just took the money out and ran and left the government to pick up the pieces, I don't think that's easy to sustain in relation to the real leaders of these institutions, who actually in many cases lost most of their net worth. So I find, you know, this incentive thing is part of the story in particular markets. I think it's part of it in the securitization market. But in my view, it's related closely, and the best remedy to it is in terms of capital. Because one of the reasons, or the main reason, I think, why in investment banks there was a lot of risk-taking was because people didn't actually price the risk properly. You know, that it looked as if you could put on huge positions and you didn't have to hold any reserves against them because you thought they were hedged. And that's really why people put on these huge positions, from which they benefited in the short term. But what the best constraint on that would be that you couldn't do that unless you had a big capital charge, which would reduce the profitability of these massive positions. So, yes, I do agree there was an incentive issue, but I think the best remedy to it is actually through, you know, allocating capital to risk better, which then prevents this exaggerated risk-taking behaviour. And I think that's, in the long run, much more effective than fiddling around with controls on remuneration and how much can be given in cash and in shares, etc. And as for your general point, well, you know, I'm a bit cynical about politicians in this. I mean, initially, there was a rather sort of frank admissions, you know, that some of the regulations have been wrong, and central banks have got it wrong, etc. But of course, as politicians approach an election, it's pretty stupid to say it's your fault. So you then say, well, it's the banks, you know. And that took a while for that rhetoric to be established. But that's what you've now got in the political domain. And the banks have just got to live with that. Because, you know, in political terms, it's kind of true enough to say that. Now, my concern, I've got to say, in London, is that financial services remains, whatever we might wish, it remains a hugely important industry for the UK. And we may have romantic rhetoric from governments, and this is not a party political point, we've got it from the last government, we've got it from this government, about how we're going to see a revival of British manufacturing and all of that. Maybe. But I wouldn't hold my breath, actually. And I think that, you know, one of our big competitive advantages is the City of London, financial intermediation, business services related to it, etc. And I think we would be very foolish if we kicked that out by, you know, running a sort of vendetta against the banks, because I'm not totally sure what we're going to replace it with. I suspect that financial intermediation will not be as exciting as it was in the last decade and the next decade, partly because of what I said about the cost of credit going up. I don't think the financial sector will expand much more rapidly than the economy, the real economy, as it has done for the previous two decades. But nonetheless, you know, the London financial machine is a very important national asset. And I think we need a slightly more balanced rhetoric about the faults of the financial sector than we've had in the last year or so.
Yeah. From the theory, I'm not
tired.
You said that it would be £300 an event, and the event was a little bit of money in the character of credit knowledge, other control companies. And in reality, I learned from others, and then said that in actually in China, that 10 effect is very much 48 times over the original amount, while the member of the special bank is choosing the 11 bank. And he said that they 2.5 times over the original amount. The question here is, do you think it's true, or do you agree with that paper, or how do you think the paper is being translated?
I don't completely recognize those figures. I mean, what is distinctive about the Chinese banks is the low loan to deposit ratio that they have, or high deposit to loan ratio. Because of the very high savings rate in China. And so Chinese banks do find it quite easy to get retail deposits, and therefore they have a more stable funding base than many Western institutions. You know, the loan to deposit rates in the UK and in most of Europe are, you know, well above 100%, and you know, here they're typically below. So I think that the multiplier you're talking about is influenced by how you are funding, how you fund your liabilities. And if you fund your liabilities through retail deposits, I think you tend to have less of a multiplier effect than if you're funding through the wholesale markets. I think that's kind of the heart of what he's saying. Yeah.
I have a question about the stock market development. Because as we know that in China, this market is divided into three parts and regulated by three different authorities. And also, this stock market on the exchange is less development than that one regulated by the central bank. So, do you think it's a problem, and how to regulate market?
Yeah, well, it is a problem, and curiously enough, Dai Shandong said exactly that the other night, so I'm not saying anything that senior Chinese authorities don't understand. I mean, he said very clearly, you know, if we're going to develop the bond market, we've got to have better organised regulation of it. I think there are sort of four things probably that are required to develop the bond market. One is to sort out the regulation and have one regulator, which probably should be the CSRC, really. The second thing is that you need to develop credit ratings. Now, that seems kind of unpopular when people are abusing credit rating agencies around the world, but you do need some kind of credit signalling mechanism. And of course, you can't have that unless you're prepared to issue unguaranteed bonds. And the problem at the moment is most of the bonds issued in China are one way or another state guaranteed. And therefore, there's no real incentive for credit rating to develop because there isn't much to say. I mean, if the government is standing behind it all, so you need to be, you know, bolder in having non-guaranteed issues, if you like, issued by entities where they don't have recourse to the government. And then lastly, you need some form of derivatives market. You certainly need interest rate derivatives. Which again sounds kind of unpopular at the moment when everybody's saying derivatives were part of our problem, but in this case I think you won't get a bond market unless you've got interest rate futures and swaps, etc. In fact, the British London, the Futures and Options Association did a study 2 or 3 years ago for China about how this could be done, which they sort of gave to the CSRC. So there is, you know, somewhere in there a plan as to how this can be developed. But I think you've got to do all those four things if you really want the bond market to develop well.
Thank you.
Perhaps we should just take one more if there is one more, and then we'll touch.
Maybe I was coming up. If there was a Chinese credit rating agency, one of the ones that is not owned by foreign companies, recently published its own version of international financial reality, and sharply downgraded the credit rating for Western government debt. I think the UK went down to AA minus, and upgraded assessment of developing country debt, in particular China, which became AAA rated, I think. You had a chart where you said who's riskier.
Yeah.
Does that mean that you agree with Darkon's credit rating? If not, why not?
I think my view is that actually China should be upgraded. But I'm not sure that I believe that the UK should be downgraded. I've talked to the Moody's people. I mean, the Moody's economist who runs their credit, sovereign credit, a very good man, French economist, used to work for the Bank of France. And, really, they've got quite a sophisticated methodology. And basically, their observation is that you run into strains when 10% of your expenditure is going into debt servicing. And we're still quite a long way away from that. There's also not much doubt about taxable capacity in the UK. You know, our tax system works pretty well, pretty effectively, and on the whole, there is a broad public confidence in it. And therefore, if necessary, it is possible to raise increased taxes. I mean, you might do something nasty to your economy when you do it, but it's doable. And that's really the issue. The issue is, can you raise revenue if you need to in order to repay this debt? And in my view, on those really brutal measures, the UK still scores quite highly. Our tax system is quite efficient. It's quite difficult to avoid it and evade it. The level of kind of civic honesty in terms of paying taxes is quite high. And so I think it's perfectly possible to pay our debt back. And I think that the system is robust in the UK. So I don't think we should be downgraded. But it does seem to me probably that some other countries are getting into territory, and China may be one, where some of the kind of discount on its credit rating that's been imposed in the past may be removed. I mean, there is, however, frankly, an issue about convertibility. And the flexibility of the exchange rate, and that's one reason why China does not get a AAA rating, because they say, this market could be manipulated. We could get our money back, but it could be at an artificial rate because the government could just manipulate the exchange rate up or down to pay us more or less. That's really why you're less sure about China's AAA status. This is not these ratings. If you talk to the people, they're not as scientific as they sound. It's that kind of impression. It's, do you think that the UK population will stand for it if you suddenly put income tax up by 5p if you really need to pay your debt? Well, your answer to that is as good as the Moody's economist. I mean, it's an impressionistic view. And do you think that if it came to it, the Chinese government would actually seek to, as it were, tax foreign holders of debt by manipulating the exchange rate before paying them back? Do you think they'd do that or not? A difficult question to answer, but that's what lies behind these ratings, not any really sophisticated kind of algorithm, actually. Because in some ways the numbers are quite simple. They're out there. You can work out what you need to pay back. I think we probably ambassador has kindly hosted us this evening, but does have other things to do, and so we're going to outstay our welcome if we don't wind up now. So let me thank you again for your hosting this event. And
I can't really imagine a more interesting or stimulating way to spend an evening, and it's been an absolute pleasure for me personally. I hope you've all got a lot of value out of it. I mean, an extremely useful primer for me as we head into an autumn of high-level meetings between our two governments, which will where these many of these issues will feature heavily. And it's very appropriate, I think, that your slide presentation sort of ended up with some of the big political questions that we will be wrestling with internationally and in our discussions between the two governments after the summer break. So thank you again enormously. Thank you on behalf of the audience. And please come back and do it again.